Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past 15 years, the U.S. prison population has more than doubled. There are currently 2.3 million people behind bars. With a little more than 4% of the world's population, the U.S. accounts for a quarter of the planet's prisoners. It has more inmates than the leading 35 European countries combined. More than 60% of U.S. prisoners are Black or Hispanic, according to the Pew Center on the States. The prison industry is now the second fastest growing spending category for states, behind only Medicaid, costing $50 billion annually and accounting for one of every 14 discretionary dollars. In a recent New York Times op-ed, Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, notes that 30 years of civil rights litigation and advocacy have failed to slow the pace of a racially biased drug war or to prevent the emergence of a penal system of astonishing size. Yet a few short years of tight state budgets have inspired former Get Tough True Believers to suddenly denounce the costs of imprisonment. We're wasting tax dollars on prisons, they say. It's time to shift course. The push to reform the prison system has brought unlikely allies together. Earlier this year, the NAACP joined forces with Newt Gingrich, who is part of a new prison reform initiative called Right on Crime. So can people from different political backgrounds work together on prison reform? Where are they beginning, and what is their main message? Today we're joined by Chris DeRoche. He is Director of External Affairs with Prison Fellowship. They work with government officials to reform and fix the criminal justice system. Last June, Chris was charged with carrying a gun while drunk. He spent 6 months on probation and is now working to reform the system. He is former House Speaker, a Republican who represented parts of Metro Detroit in Michigan for much of the past decade. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
And I know I'm a new guest out there, so my name is Craig.
Oh, Craig, you know, I'm sorry. Well, we actually, we had someone else from your group joining us, and he just called in sick. So thanks for joining us, Craig. Sorry about that.
No problem.
We're also joined by Tim Kavanaugh, managing editor of Reason.com. That's the website for the libertarian Reason magazine. The cover of Reason's July issue says, "Criminal Injustice Inside America's National Disgrace." Articles covered everything from prosecutorial misconduct on death row to the costs involved in leading the world in locking up human beings. And Tim wrote a piece about how California prison guards became the country's most powerful union. And he joins us from LA. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So why don't we start off with you, Craig? You've got an interesting background and a story that gave you sort of a taste of how the system works. Why don't you tell us what happened to you?
Well, my public career is pretty well documented out there, and I served on a local city and also in the legislature and as Speaker of the House at a pretty young age. I was 34 years old when I was elected Speaker. And in the background all of that, I had known full well that I was an alcoholic since I was a very young child, even before the age of 14. But at age 14 is when I really couldn't stop drinking every day. And so I had this demon, if you will, that I was very dishonest about and kept out of public view. And it really showed up on the stage with a vengeance in 2010. And while I didn't get an extensive amount of trouble in the criminal justice system because of you know, being able to work through it and becoming honest, I guess would be the way to describe it. What I revealed was a far deeper problem than I had than just what I was arrested for. And from what I've learned through that process, through going through rehabilitation, from working with others that suffer an addiction and also that have been incarcerated, that are looking to turn their lives around, I've really felt a very passionate and strong call to become involved in this movement and just very grateful that I've been able to start working with the Justice Fellowship out of Lansdowne, Virginia, along with Pat Nolan. It was founded by Chuck Colson, the former political director for Richard Nixon, who also founded Prison Fellowship. And We work with others such as Reason Magazine, the Cato Institute on the libertarian side, as well as others in the growing conservative libertarian and liberal movements for criminal justice reform.
Well, and Pat Nolan, he was supposed to be on today, but he got sick. His story is fascinating. He was the Republican leader of the California State Assembly for 4 years. He spent 15 years in the California legislature. He was convicted of accepting campaign contributions that turned out to be part of an FBI sting. He spent 29 months in jail, and he did a complete 180. I mean, here's a guy who sort of espouse the what we hear from a lot of politicians, tough on crime rhetoric, and he completely shifted after spending so much time in jail.
Well, going back to what you said when you set up this segment of the show, you gave these just astounding statistics about what is actually going on in America, mm-hmm. and I think the truth is that just about every American at some level of their lives, if they were being honest and living transparently and had a camera following them around, is committing any number of misdemeanors and probably a surprising number of people committing felonies just through the course of any given day. We've over-criminalized our laws, and I think what it takes is it's hard for people to be honest about their own lives until they have had them exposed. So what I think you've seen in Pat Nolan and myself and others that have had the truth come out about our own failings as people, that we also are free then to talk about the failings of what we're doing when we're trying to get, quote-unquote, tough on crime, or we're trying to improve, is what we saw as an improvement of our laws, are anything but improvements and are anything but things that will prevent crimes from being committed, from people from returning to prison. In fact, we're pushing ourselves away from that goal with many of our policies, and so that's where we spend our time working, is to enlighten conservatives who have believed that this is a liberal notion, that the criminal justice system needs reform, and to join with others that have been in it for some time, like the good folks at Reason Magazine and Tim who have been fighting for this for decades in America. We're trying to help by bringing the conservative voice to the table.
And Tim, what are your thoughts on this? What do you think is most effective when you're trying to, I mean, you're trying to convince politicians, even a lot of Democrats who are afraid that they'll be branded soft on crime. You're also trying to convince a public. Here in California, a proposition to overturn three strikes failed. So how do you reach out to people?
Well, you raise an interesting point, and I mean, I say interesting in the sense of, awful, but I don't want to call it that. I would actually question both yours and Craig's points that somehow this is a conservative notion of wanting to lock everybody up in three. I mean, I seem to remember Mario Cuomo, the great liberal governor of New York, being the pioneer of three strikes. I remember California, the most liberal state in the nation, leading the nation down the three strikes hole. When I look at efforts to repeal three strikes, I don't see it coming from the 1%, although I'm sure quite a few people in the California Correctional Peace Officers Association are members of the 1%. But real objection to that is coming from the unions. So I say that with a heavy heart, because it means that, once again, as a libertarian, I find myself a total orphan in America, because this is very popular. It seems popular to this day. It's unclear how much of it is fueled by, propaganda in favor of three strikes laws. It's unclear how much of it is fueled by the news media's obsessive focus on crime and blood. And how much of it is due to, CSI or something else. But, basically, it's popular to lock people up, and it's popular to get tough on crime. And, unfortunately, you say tough on crime, it's kind of a broad definition. Like, we all want to be tough on crime. We all want to make sure crime gets punished and non-guilty people don't get punished. But the way it gets put into practice, I guess we're going to talk a little more about right now.
Right. Well, and so how do you explain why the U.S. has such a high incarceration rate, 2.3 million people behind bars?
We illegalize a ton of stuff. We have, you know, just more laws and more regulations than any human being would be able to read. You could not. I mean, I live in Los Angeles. It would be impossible for me to read the entire legal code that I live under, to you know every law of the city of Los Angeles and every law of the county of Los Angeles, and then every law of California and every law of the United States, and who knows what international treaties we're signatory to now that can get you locked up for, you know, not having enough water on your farm or something, or having too much water on your farm.
Well, and why don't you tell us who's really involved in this movement? Because the media does like to, you know, put things in this sort of left-right liberal-conservative box.
Yeah.
And libertarians are rarely even mentioned in the dialogue, although Ron Paul is now getting more media attention. But who else is involved in this effort that we might not hear about?
As you can tell from the other guests, I mean, the faith-based groups are you know, very active in prisons, and that's not at all limited to Christianity, and you know, that's traditionally, again, this isn't something new. I mean, it's news because it's the oldest thing in the book. You know, the only person who's available to you in prison tends to be somebody representing a deity, a religion of some sort. So, you know, that's where you see a lot of activity on this. Traditionally, from the ACLU, when you see groups associated with you know, the well-being of a particular ethnic group, the NAACP and so forth, those you will see well represented too, because, you know, it's not just perceived, but it's numerical that, you know, the way the legal system works, and, you know, from the war on drugs on down or on up in the United States, tends to incarcerate more minorities than white people. So that's another one. Libertarians, I mean, we're a small portion, but we're out there. And I think a lot of people, without thinking of themselves as libertarians and possibly even being horrified by libertarians, lean pretty libertarian on a lot of stuff. And this is one of them. And this is not an unusual idea. It's in the Constitution that cruel and unusual punishment is outlawed. And throughout the Constitution and throughout the Enlightenment and throughout all of the sort of founding, you know, notions of the United States, you'll find a stream of non-cruelty, of lowest use of force for the state to attain its ends of, you know, that should be pretty limited ends of just security and freedom for the citizens. You know, I think Americans widely agree on that. We've gotten, I would say, maybe a little off the track by being so afraid of crime, which is, you know, oddly continues to drop. Mm. And yet we continue to be more afraid of it.
Right. That is Tim Kavanaugh. He is managing editor of Reason.com. That's the website for the libertarian Reason magazine. The cover of their July issue says Criminal Injustice Inside America's National Disgrace. We're also joined by Craig DeRoche, director of external affairs with Prison Fellowship. They work with government officials to reform the criminal system. And now I'd like to welcome Robert Perkinson to the show. Robert is assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii and author of Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire, which won the 2011 Penn John Kenneth Galbraith Award for Nonfiction. Hi, Robert. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So before I ask you about these various coalitions, we've got 2.3 million people behind bars. How many of those people are behind bars for nonviolent offenses like drug possession?
It depends how you slice the numbers. About half.
About half.
A little less than half. But because people who are convicted of the nonviolent offenses go in and out at a faster rate, whereas people convicted of serious offenses stay longer, a high majority of the people who go to prison each year are going in for nonviolent offenses.
And
the lion's share of the growth in imprisonment in the United States over the last 40 years has been among low-level nonviolent and drug offenders.
Okay. So what we're doing today is talking about how individuals and organizations with varying political backgrounds are coming together to work on prison reform. And earlier this year, the NAACP joined forces with Newt Gingrich, who's part of a new reform initiative called Right on Crime. What else are you seeing out there? What really strikes you about different groups coming together?
Well, I mean, I vary in my optimism. On the one hand, I was quite optimistic at the start of the Obama administration because it seemed like, you know, the head of the federal government and Eric Holder would be interested in beginning to roll back the colossal increase in incarceration that's unlike anything the world has ever seen. Jim Webb in the Senate was putting together a pretty impressive bipartisan coalition to look at prison reduction for the first time since Lyndon Johnson's Katzenbach Commission in 1967. There was the court order in California. All sorts of states, even Texas, were looking at controlling corrections costs because of the economic downturn. But I must say I'm a little less optimistic now. I mean, in the same way that this country has become as ungovernable as Iraq or other democracies that kind of get scorn in the evening TV news, there's just really not a lot significant that's happening. The Webb bill has collapsed. California is, you know, accelerating toward the abyss. And other leading states like Texas have moderated the pace of prison growth but haven't really started to reverse it.
So you're not very helpful in terms of what's going on at the government level?
Right. And, of course, that's, you know, for 40 years, every legislative session in almost every state, most intensively in the South, but other places, you know, lawmakers have made the situation worse by creating new crimes, by extending sentences, by cutting back programs, by increasing prison construction. And it's going to take a lot of government action and grassroots mobilization to force its hand to turn this around and to begin to dismantle this incredibly wasteful and harmful system.
Hmm. Chris DeRoche, what do you think? Robert Perkinson isn't very hopeful. What are you seeing on the ground? Are you seeing many changes?
I've been speaking about this around the country on panels, and what I've learned is that the political template that has been created, that is anybody left of you know, a conservative Republican that is working on these issues, things collapse around them. And what Senator Webb is doing, he's never been accused of being a liberal, but they're afraid to take the initiative. Not Senator Webb, but many leaders at the state level from the left, and so it leaves a void. And so what we try to do is we try to encourage folks from the that are known as take a leadership role, because that's where we've seen the most success when we had reforms within the federal and standards of how we were going to treat the prisoners. It fared better because Senator Sessions introduced the legislation, we found. And so we're out there working with, and as a former, I was Speaker of the House in Michigan, but also Minority Leader. So I had 2 years of majority and 2 years of being a caucus leader, and having to work with the members of my caucus that were conservative socially, as Christian conservatives, libertarian, or fiscal conservatives, where their primary concerns were. And all of them had concerns of whether or not they could deliver on, you know, the return of liberty, the savings of cost, but most importantly, could they actually live up to the government's responsibility to keep the community safe? And what we're seeing with the reforms have been mentioned in Texas, and what, you know, they're going forward with in South Carolina and Ohio, and in so many other states are starting to move forward with, is the answer is yes, we can do that. We can be smart on crime or right on crime, whatever slogan you want to put on it, that people understand what Tim pointed out. There isn't anything conservative about telling somebody if they broke in and stole my car. That their punishment is that the taxpayers are going to pay for their air conditioning and their heat, and they can cool their heels for 60, 90 days, you know, 6 months, whatever, if they're a repeat offender. A more conservative approach in how our country was founded is on the principles of restorative justice. That person should pay back to society what damage it is that they did. And if they're not capable of doing that, or they're unwilling to, that their prison sentence should be, or their incarceration, or their punishment otherwise, should be proportionate to what it is that they did. And it seems that those scales of justice, that perspective, has been lost in the halls of the legislature. I'm more optimistic than Robert. I do believe that this is gaining a lot of interest in the Republican caucuses and with the Republican governors that have just taken hold after 2010. This is becoming one of the key areas of reform that they want to pursue, and it's keeping us busy, and that creates enthusiasm at Justice Fellowship for the work.
And I'm curious, Craig, after you were charged with carrying a gun while drunk, you got 6 months probation. What are your thoughts on the way you were handled and sentenced based on the fact that you are a former politician and you're a white man?
Well, I'm one of those unique examples. I was actually not sentenced. That case was dismissed because the prosecutor charged me with possession of a firearm while intoxicated, and I was not even on the same floor of my house as the gun. So, and it's a liberal Democratic prosecutor. So the problem is that the prosecutor and I didn't get along very well. and so I was treated differently, in my opinion, because of the dynamics of the case, just as I believe the individuals, unfortunately, that are brought in the criminal justice system are treated unfairly far too often. But I had my day. The police officer testified that I wasn't on the same floor as my gun, and I believe the judge said, well, you may as well have charged him for drunk driving because he had a car in the garage. He was in his own house. So, it was dismissed, but the lesson and the exposure to the criminal justice system was learned by me. I was on probation for a previous offense for a drunk driving incident, and that was something that I did plead guilty to and that I was on probation for. And both of those experiences, as well as my involvement in recovery circles, recovery from addiction, whether it be drugs or alcohol, you come into a lot of people's stories about what has happened in their lives. Mm. And I tell my conservative friends that what we're doing with the current sentencing practices of, as I say, quote unquote, being tough on crime, is what we're doing is we're breaking up families. We're taking a parent, a mother or a father away from their children. We're preventing them from the ability to provide for their family and to restore themselves, to pay back what they did with the punishments that we're giving them. And we're not doing anything, as I said, that resembles conservatism as I understood it. And I get to see that firsthand, and I get to hear the stories, and I get to see.
And quickly, Craig, before we go to break, what are the responses you receive?
I see light bulbs going off everywhere. I see dots being connected, and people saying, I needed someone like you to tell me these stories because you're living them, and you know these people personally, because they've been looking for, they didn't feel that things were right. And I'm seeing a lot of enthusiasm, growing enthusiasm, and I'm just excited with every conservative leader I've been talking with around the country. I've not had anybody tell me they think I'm off base when I describe to them what's going on.
And after the break, I'd love to ask if you think this might turn into any legislative action. Today we're talking about what it will take to really reform the growing prison system in this country. What happens when groups from different political backgrounds get together? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. You know, the end of the year is a great time to remember those that you hold dear. We hope that KALW makes your list. We've been nice, you know, rarely naughty, and we'll continue to innovate in the new year with your support. Please consider making a special year-end gift at our website, kalw.org. Thanks, and happy holidays from your friends here at KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we will talk about the Occupy movement. On Monday, several West Coast cities shut down their ports, and some inland cities, Occupy movements, attempted to halt operations at Walmart headquarters. A lot of people are putting their heads together and talking about what the targets should be. Should it be the ports? Should it be the banks? What do you think the target should be? What is most effective? That's tomorrow, Friday. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what it will take to reform the prison system. There are 2.3 million people behind bars in the United States. About half are in for nonviolent offenses, including drug use. With a little more than 4% of the world's population, the U.S. accounts for a quarter of the planet's prisoners and has inmates, more inmates than the leading 35 European countries combined. Today, we're joined by Chris DeRoche. He is Director of External Affairs with Prison Fellowship. They work with government officials to reform the criminal justice system. Chris is a former Michigan House speaker. Last June, he was charged with carrying a gun while drunk, and he spent 6 months on probation. We're also joined by Robert Perkinson, assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii and author of Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. Tim Kavanaugh is managing editor of Reason.com, the website for the libertarian Reason magazine, and their July issue says criminal injustice inside America's national disgrace. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on various efforts to reform the prison system? And what do you think about groups from different backgrounds getting together? What would be most effective? And when it comes to prison reform, where should we begin? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Tim, based on the package you put together for Reason magazine, where would you begin when it comes to prison reform?
Stop passing new laws. Put at least a 10-year moratorium on new laws at the city, state, and federal level. And try. See if we can still get by as a civilization with the millions of pages of law that exist in the United States right now. That would be the first thing. And the war on drugs would be actually the first thing. You could get rid of a huge body of really cancerous U.S. Legal code just by eliminating the war on drugs, and to the greatest extent possible, decriminalizing all of these substances that can be abused. As Craig had his own problem, and I'm happy to hear he seems to be dealing with that as it should be dealt with, as a health issue and not as a shame issue and so forth. That we can do that. That would be a great place to start. As I guess Robert noted, we are incarcerating mostly nonviolent. I mean, that's where the greatest growth is coming from right now, is from nonviolent offenders. A lot of that is coming from the war on drugs. They all tell you that they don't do it anymore, but in fact, lots of people are still going to prison for having a bag of pot throughout these United States. I'd also rephrase a little bit of what Robert said, where he indicated that President Obama's inability to, or, you know, and especially Attorney General Holder's inability, as Robert put it, to make any kind of reform keeps getting blocked as a sign that the country is ungovernable. This is the government getting the results that it wants. This is the Obama administration getting the results that it wants. Since Obama, you can check it on page 33 of that issue of Reason. You can check it out. Probation and parole have both been going down in numbers since Obama came into office, while the rate of imprisonment continues to rise. So I do not hold President Obama either passively or actively blameless in this.
What do you think, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, the Obama administration has not made criminal justice reform a priority. On the other hand, you know, they've signaled a willingness to increase money for indigent defense, and they've kind of half-heartedly asserted some willingness to insert sanity and evidence into the drug war, although it's true they haven't really taken any steps
they
in that regard.
They haven't done it out here.
They
haven't done it in California.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's not a cause that the administration should be championed for. I think there are political reasons for it.
It's not only championing it, it's doing more raids than Bush did.
In the drug war side? I mean, I would add...
No, raids on medical marijuana dispensaries, the things that the people want.
I would add to the things that Tim suggested, and it's going to take people in the streets, I think, forcing the hand of state lawmakers first and probably second, federal lawmakers in the Obama administration. But, you know, sentences in the U.S. need to be shorter. We sentence drug offenders to longer sentences than were dished out to Nazi war criminals after World War II. We need to restore judicial discretion. Because mandatory sentencing, mandatory minimums, and all sorts of added statutes that are larding up the books have really just located all of the discretion in our system in the hands of prosecutors, and that's why they are able to charge people with kind of untenable crimes, like it sounds like happened to Craig, and more money for indigent defense, if we want to spend money, and more money for early childhood kind of programs, which is where you get the most bang for your buck in terms of real public safety. I think it's promising that the right on crime movement and the kind of fiscally driven set of reforms that are gaining some traction in state governments. So I'm all in favor of it, and the extent that the right and the left can kind of find common cause in this area, it's encouraging. I don't think really the scale of the changes that need to be enacted are going to come about through a kind of utilitarian fiscal argument. There are, you know, big movements in American history, abolitionism, civil rights, suffrage, of the sort of movement that we're going to need in order to unravel this system that's really unlike anything any democratic government has ever constructed. Only totalitarian regimes like Mao and Hitler and Stalin have ever imprisoned their population at the rate that the United States is doing. That's going to take a real move in the streets where people kind of decide that it's un-American, it's unjust, it's undemocratic, and it's contrary to the ideals of freedom. And I hope that begins to happen. But so far, we're not seeing the sort of effort that needs to take place. But maybe we're at a tipping point.
I would second that, also, since Craig is coming from a faith-based place, we may all be in agreement on this. I don't think utilitarian approaches are what we need here. This is not a question of rearranging a few deck chairs or even shortening sentences. This is a matter of changing people's hearts, of saying you actually don't need to live in a society of nonstop punishment in order to maintain basic law and order and civility.
Yay.
Well, we'll dive into this a little deeper, but I first want to take a caller who has to go soon. Let's go to Carlisle in Carmel Valley. Hi, Carlisle.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I heard a couple days ago on NPR that there is such a thing in the United States as debtor's prison. I was amazingly shocked. And supposedly 140,000 people are in this system, and it's the collection agencies, I guess. I mean, I'd need more history on this, are, you know, bringing up these cases, and we all know how cheesy collection agencies are. And then the judges, there's all this illegal stuff going on within that system. And, I mean, this might be something Occupy might want to take up. And then also as a solution, and I don't know if this is still going on, I inherited some prison stock, and I immediately sold it. So anybody who has prison stock, unload it. I mean, that is a function, I think, in our society still. I mean, this was years ago when I inherited. And thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Robert, what can you tell us about debtor's prison?
I have not thought. I mean, it's debtor's prison, at least narrowly conceived, is illegal in every state in the union. But there may be ways that prosecutors and collections agencies and creditors are coming up with ways to put people in jail for contempt or
Yeah, I just found this NPR story. It says, although debtors' prisons are illegal, it's becoming increasingly common for people to serve jail time as a result of their debt. Collection agencies are resorting to unusually harsh tactics to force people to pay their unpaid debt.
But it's not, I mean, it fits with what's happened to this to this country as a whole. I mean, once upon a time, in the great society, whatever its flaws, when the public and politicians confronted seemingly intractable social problems, the response was to try to kind of craft some sort of programs and devote resources to make them better. And our approach these days is to punish people. Our schools have become more prison-like, with more security and more zero tolerance, and more kind of criminal justice type proceedings. The workplace has become more criminal justice-like and more punitive, with fewer rights for workers. We've become a kind of, instead of a great society, a mean society. And I think Tim is right that the country needs to kind of have a moral reckoning with the whole way our society is organized. The harshest element of it is the way we treat people convicted of crimes, but the sort of inequality that we're tolerating as a society, it is corrosive to a sense of collective well-being and a healthy democracy, too. So, you know, one hopes maybe the Occupy movement will start, that you're going to be talking about tomorrow, will start changing the conversation, and prison reform can kind of ride that wave all the way to the beach. But I am worried that we don't yet have enough we haven't yet have enough momentum to turn the corner.
Well, thank you for calling in, Carlisle. And I'd love to hear from you. What momentum do you think would allow advocates of prison reform to turn the corner? What message would actually work? What strategies would really work when you're talking about prison reform? 2.3 million people are behind bars, about half for nonviolent offenses. And it just keeps going up. It's costing $50 billion annually here in California. It costs about $50,000 per prisoner. That's more than what it costs to send students to school. So what message do you think would actually work? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So, Craig, what do you think? I mean, we're talking about whether this can come through a fiscal argument, whether this comes through a moral argument. What do you think would be most effective here? Craig?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Craig, go ahead. Oh, Craig, are you there?
I guess he's off.
I think we lost. We'll reconnect with him. He probably got mad because I kept calling him Chris on accident.
I think that's what it was. It was one.
Or he could think that what we all need is a moment of silence.
Well, we'll reconnect with him. What do you think, Tim? What's most effective?
Most effective in terms of crafting a message.
Most, yes, because it seems like
widely sellable. Yeah. First, the punishment should fit the crime is something that I think a lot of people might take to. And if you really think that one through, the number of people, and I, you know, having spent a lot of time criticizing prison guards, and especially California's, I will say they have a tough job. They do protect society from those who have been deemed so horrific that society needs to be protected from them, that they need to be locked away where they can't prey upon the rest of us. And so that's a real thing. However, that having been said, the number of people who are like that, the number of people that society needs to be really forcefully protected from, is quite small. I mean, it's really a vanishingly small number of people. And that's one way to start with it. I mean, if you took money, you should make restitution to the other person, or you should do whatever you can to make them whole. They talk a little bit about debtors' prisons. What the caller was referring to, I think, was a more metaphorical thing. People that have been, creditors have pushed them hard enough that they've managed to get them on other little technicalities and things like that. They can imprison you for lots of stuff. Mm. So that's what we're talking about. It wouldn't be that hard to get 140,000 people out of 300 million into a system like that. So, but beyond that, we have very broad bankruptcy rules. We have a lot of ways for people to get out of contractual debt that they have committed to. and so forth. And in cases where something got stolen, I mean, you do whatever you can to make the other person whole. But for the most part, you know, there aren't really that many people who have to be physically locked away in order to pay their debt to society. We could really reduce the prison population that way. I obviously, as a libertarian, I have broader concerns. I'd like to see the war on drugs ended, which I think would basically solve your problem. It would solve the prison overcrowding problem, certainly in California.
Well, we definitely talk about that a lot on this show, and we're actually going to do a show about the crackdown on medical marijuana dispensaries in the new year. What do you think, Robert? What is the most effective message?
It's a tough call. I mean, the message right now that seems to be capable of propelling a bill through a state legislature is a wasted resource public safety argument. You know, I mean, we have a system in the U.S. as a whole that is, I mean, if 40 years ago an evil cabal was to sit down and decide what is the most expensive, wasteful, ineffective, and harmful criminal justice system that we could possibly conceive for America, and they wanted to outline 500 policy recommendations in order to implement it, that's what we've done over the last 40 years. And so, you know, being smart on crime, sane on crime, applying some evidence and reasonableness to sanctions. Those arguments seem to be carrying the day at the moment, but I worry they won't be strong enough to really propel the scale of change we need. And so, I mean, it could be that so other arguments are, you know, to point out the racial disparities and to recall kind of civil other big justice racial justice narratives that have propelled movements in American history. This really is the new frontier of the civil rights movement and ought to be. Another way to conceive of it maybe is to talk about it in terms of freedom. There's this political scientist in New York, Corey Robin, who talks about whatever political movement controls the meaning of the term freedom in American politics rules the day. And this is one of the great threats to the value that Americans hold most dear. So if we, you know, there's a lot of people revolting about supposed threats to their liberty because of getting rid of incandescent light bulbs. If we can take some portion of those people, and the libertarians, some of them are certainly trying to do that, and get them concerned about locking people up at huge expense for huge amounts of time and wrecking their life for really very little public benefit, then maybe we'll start getting somewhere.
And that is Robert Perkinson. He's author of Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. Tim Kavanaugh is managing editor of Reason.com, the website for Reason magazine. Their July issue was dedicated to this topic. Their cover story says Criminal Injustice Inside America's National Disgrace. And we have Craig DeRoche back. He's director of external affairs with Prison Fellowship. They work with government officials to fix the criminal justice system. Craig is former Michigan House Speaker, a Republican who last June was charged with carrying a gun while drunk and spent 6 months on probation. And if you'd like to join us, we've got about 5 minutes left. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 2.3 million people are behind bars, about half for nonviolent offenses. What message would really grab the public's attention when it comes to prison reform? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Robert in Carmel Valley. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Yeah, I just got released from federal prison for growing medical marijuana, and, you know, it's just completely ridiculous the state, you know, allows us to do this. And there's 15 states in California that advocate, you know, the use of marijuana for medicine, and we worked with local advocacy groups, with our sheriff's department, and even came up with up in Mendocino County, came up with a tagging system, and they've been getting threats from the Department of Justice, threatening to lock up city officials. We don't know what to do anymore. I can't go near this stuff anymore, but I'm a strong advocate for medical marijuana. And I think, you know, it's really ridiculous the amount of money the taxpayers have to spend on people that are law-abiding as citizens. And, you know, just to go a little more on my situation, when I was on pretrial, they said I had a drug habit. They made me go to drug rehab. They spent $6,000 a month in a private rehab, and I didn't have a drug problem. You know, the rehab was great, and I think that money could have been spent on people that actually needed the help. But, you know, these are the kinds of things that, you know, we have to look at.
Robert, how much time did you serve?
You know, I got a year and a day, which is a really short sentence for a situation like mine, but in the Northern District of California, because the number of cases, they're a little more lenient as far as sentencing goes. But like, let's say, the Eastern District, someone in my situation would have gotten a five-year mandatory minimum.
Wow. So. You know, the other thing we don't talk about is the prison experience. What was that like for you? How did it change you?
Well, you know, I meet a lot of people in there, and I was low-level. So there was a lot of white-collar crime, a lot of people that were in there unjustly. One guy, he ran a business. His partners found a way to take over the business by turning him in for tax fraud. And, you know, there's a lot of different, very intelligent people in federal prisons. And, you know, I even met someone there who was a Native American who was discriminated against and got 14 years for absolutely nothing, no evidence. They even dropped the state case, but they can get people on conspiracy without hardly any evidence. It takes one person getting in trouble, wanting to get out of trouble. They make a deal with the district attorney, and they point the finger at someone who's completely innocent. And this happens all the time. You just don't hear about it.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Robert, and I hope that you'll be able to call in to our show when we talk about medical marijuana next month. Thank you for calling. Let's hear from Fred in Prunedale. Hi, Fred.
Hi. In California, in 1975, an experiment was started to resolve the prison problem. It was highly successful, lasted for 19 years until Governor Wilson, with the law and order self-righteousness thing, closed it down. The program was self-supporting. It educated approximately 200 inmates a year who graduated with associate's degrees. It was a degree-granting program, and it was self-supporting. It formed a model that should have been copied throughout California. The first thing it did was look at the prison as a community, where everybody that was there was involved in the community, including the guards and the administration. And it worked because we had everyone invested in an institution, i.e. the educational program at Soledad, that would help benefit everybody. And it worked, and it worked for 19 years in one of the most vicious prisons in the state, in the nation. And it worked because it was set up right, and it would work again today. It would resolve the problem with gangs by building a sense of entitlement and community within the prisons, because California state prisons is the cause of the rise of gang throughout the nation, because California instituted a policy of administrative segregation, which meant that all the gang guys hung out with their buddies in prison. Mm-hmm. What this did was form a cooperative that has made gangs organized throughout this country. The Department of Corrections and the state of California is culpable for this rise in gang warfare because of their policies, which were only instituted to protect themselves, not the public, and to enrich themselves. And they enrich themselves on the college program at Soledad, and I believe that's
Fred,
why it wasn't copied, because the
administrators
at Soledad didn't want to be shown up for basically stealing inmate interest money that came in from the educational program.
Thank you, Fred. Sorry to cut you off. We are almost out of time, and I just want to make sure we get in our other caller, and then we can get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Jim in Salinas. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me on. It just seems to me that there's three points that have been talked about. One is certainly the idea of public safety. The other is punishment. And the third one seems to be restitution. I've had experience with my family. Someone who was, rather than be incarcerated for a nonviolent crime, had an ankle bracelet put on. I believe he had to pay for probation. He had to pay for the ankle bracelet. He was able to work, provide restitution, but he was also punished, and in his recreational life, his freedom of movement was restricted. So the cost to the state was lifted for the crime he did, but he was punished and he provided restitution. And I just wonder why something like that can't be done for the 50% of the people who are nonviolent criminals,
right,
in the state.
Well,
that's all.
Thank you so much. We have just about 2 minutes left, so why don't you all give us your final thoughts and connect it to some of our caller comments. Robert Perkinson?
Well, I hope if we can keep this in the public eye, there are some signs that the country is starting to sober up from the prison binge. And if we can move to a system in which reason really does rule the debate, then we will have a much, much smaller prison system, a safer society, and we'll all save a lot of money and have resources to spend on meaningful and positive programs rather than negative ones. But it's going to take people out there forcing the hand of politicians, because they have been so far too cowardly and or too demagogic to act.
And we also have a few emails about just the profit behind all of this. I mean, we're talking about a lot of money here.
Yeah, and that especially has, I think that has not played as big a role in causing the buildup as is often imagined, but it is emerging as a real factor in blocking the dismantling of it. Because now that it's built, there are a lot of hands in the kitty.
Right.
And be put somewhere else.
And Tim Kavanaugh, final thoughts?
Hi. Yeah, I want to second the belief that reason should rule this debate. Somehow it never seems to happen, but I agree. And also, Robert raised a very good point. This stuff is all built. Right now, we are the revolutionaries. We are the ones who are trying to tear down the castle walls, and there are a lot of folks who want to keep it. You'd have to look to the U.S. auto industry, really, to find a more disgusting coalition of big business and big labor that's going to fight to the death till they've taken every penny out of our pockets. It's a real, real coalition that we are up against.
Wait, the what industry?
I think that's crazy. I mean, the car industry makes cars that has, like, decent jobs. There's only in California is big labor issue in prisons, but it is, he's right, it's a giant machine that needs to be dismantled. Strange metaphor, but then again, we don't have to agree on everything.
And Craig, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, just everything that the two gentlemen just said, and add in honesty. I mean, why we have a war on marijuana right now when people can be prescribed a good number of heroin addicts that I've met, whether they're young or they're soccer moms, that I would scratch my head and say, how did you end up on heroin? There's interchangeable prescription drugs that you could hand to a police officer while you're fishing around for your driver's license, and he'd hand your drugs back. But if it's marijuana, we're gonna ruin your employability for the rest of your life. So there must be a reason of why we're empire building in that section of our government, and we need to step up with honesty, and we need to turn back the clock.
Well, thank you so much. We'll definitely have you back and continue this conversation. Craig DeRoche is with Prison Fellowship. Robert Perkinson is author of Texas Tough: The Rise of America's Prison Empire, and Tim Kavanaugh is managing editor of Reason.com. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. Sorry we didn't get to all of you. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What should we occupy in 2012? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about how the movement can continue to be effective. On Monday, several West Coast occupiers shut down their ports, while other movements attempted to halt operations at Walmart headquarters. What do you think the targets should be, and what are the most effective methods? Are there ways the movement can be more inclusive? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What should Occupy 2012 look like? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.